The bomb that exploded outside the American Embassy in Beirut on April 18, 1983, killed 63 people. Among the dead was a CIA operative named Robert Ames. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Kai Bird takes an in-depth look at how Ames became one of the most important Middle East operatives in CIA history and how his death that day marked a turning point in relations between the West and the Arab world. It's called The Good Spy, The Life and Death of Robert Ames, and it's published by Crown. I'm very pleased that it brings Kai Bird back to our show. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard.
What do you mean by calling him a good spy? Are there bad spies other than the other Ames, Aldrich Ames?
Well, that's a good question. Yes, there are bad spies like Aldrich Ames, who is in jail. So
not
to
be confused,
no relation to Robert Ames. But Robert Ames is a completely unknown personality. But inside the CIA, he is legendary. And, you know, he was killed 30 years ago, but his name lives on inside Langley. And he's known just for being a very good recruiter of agents and someone who penetrated the PLO at a very dangerous moment in the 1970s in a very dangerous neighborhood, the Middle East.
Although he was rather controversial at the time, now we see the full breadth of his accomplishment.
Well, exactly. When he did this, when he formed this clandestine relationship with Yasser Arafat's intelligence chief, a young man named Ali Hassan Salameh, this was 1969 at a time when Henry Kissinger was saying, you know, we can't have anything to do, no contact, no conversations with anyone in the PLO because they're a terrorist organization. But this is exactly where a CIA clandestine officer steps in to form relationships with people who foreign service officers, diplomats, can't speak to.
What were the qualities he believed a person needed to be a good spy?
Empathy and the ability to listen. And in the Middle East, the ability to learn the language, a very difficult language, Arabic, and an ability to understand the region and the history.
Wasn't he a rarity at the CIA? As I understand it, there's practically no one there today who can speak Arabic.
Well, to put it in context, when Ames was killed in 1983 in the truck bomb attack on the U.S. Embassy, there were probably a half dozen CIA officers who could speak Arabic well enough to hold a political conversation and read the newspaper. Ames was one of them. And then on the eve of 9/11, the same number prevailed, six.
Mm-hmm.
Today, I don't know. There's probably certainly more, but not with the kind of background and knowledge of the history and empathy for the region.
One fellow CIA officer said Ames was no Lawrence of Arabia. So he had a very different approach. Well, obviously, he wasn't going to lead the military.
Right. No, he was no James Bond. He did occasionally have to carry a pistol in his waistband in dangerous places like Aden and Beirut. But he was a man who was all-American. He was literally an all-American basketball star in college. He was 6'3". He favored cowboy boots and tinted aviator glasses. He looked really American, but he was able to walk the streets of Beirut and make friends with people.
Didn't you know Robert Ames when you were growing up?
I did indeed, just by chance. My father was a Foreign Service officer, and so I grew up in the Middle East during my childhood.
In Dahran,
during Ames's first posting abroad, he was our next-door neighbor.
I'm assuming, from what I know about the CIA, that you didn't know he was in the CIA, but would your father, because he was a Foreign Service officer, have known that?
Exactly. I didn't know. I was 13 years old, but my father knew that he was agency.
What was he like? Did you like him?
He was a very personable guy who loved to play basketball with the Marines who guarded the consulate compound at the time. He had two little baby girls. He was married to a beautiful woman who looked like Liv Ullmann, blonde, blue-eyed, Norwegian background. He was just a very personable guy.
Since so much of his life was conducted in secret, Who were your sources when you were researching his life and career in the CIA? Were people in the CIA open to you? What about the people he dealt with in the Middle East?
Yes. Well, when I started this project, I went to the CIA and said I wanted to do this biography, and I asked for some limited cooperation. They said, yeah, we'll think about it, and they never got back to me. But I eventually found the widow, some of the children, and more than 40 retired CIA officers, including also four Mossad retired officers, Israeli intelligence officers. And I remember at one point sitting in Tel Aviv having dinner with one of these Mossad guys, and I was demonstrating to him how much I knew already and trying to get him to talk. And at one point he interrupts me and he says, well, Kai, is your government really going to allow you to publish all these secrets? I had to laugh, of course, because I hadn't signed any secrecy oaths. But no, I got a lot of retired intelligence people to talk to me who wanted this story told because they thought it was important, and they were 30 or 40-year-old secrets, but they were time to be told.
Now, you said that he was respected for recruiting, but wasn't he criticized for not recruiting agents rather than recruiting sources?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is an old dilemma in the world of intelligence. You know, do you have to actually get your sources, your agents, to sign a contract and take money, own them? And Ames, at times, you know, he didn't think this was so important. As long as you had a relationship of trust, that was what was important. So he got criticized by his colleagues.
But it's very hard in the Middle East to get somebody to take the money. I just saw a documentary, an Israeli documentary, in which somebody, a kid who is the son of a leader of Hamas, said that it was more acceptable to rape your mother than to cooperate with the Israelis and take money from them. That's how terrible that was considered.
Oh, it's an act of shame, yeah. And particularly after, you know, 30, 40 years later, Ames was operating in the 1960s and 70s, and it was a sort of kinder, gentler Middle East. And so there were people who were on the payroll. But Ali Hassan Salameh, Yasser Arafat's intelligence chief, absolutely refused to be recruited, to take any money. And this was true of a number of Ames's key sources.
He was called the Red Prince.
Ali Hassan was called the Red Prince.
Why?
Well, he came from sort of a notorious Palestinian aristocratic background. His father had fought as a guerrilla terrorist, freedom fighter, however you call it, in the 1948 war, which created Israel. And he was killed. His father was killed in 48. And young Ali Hassan Salameh grew up in Beirut, sort of privileged, and he was the exact opposite of Ames. He favored black gold necklaces, and he loved beautiful women and red wine and the nightclubs of Beirut. Robert Ames was a very staid, middle-class American. He was the son of a steel worker from Philadelphia. He had six children. He was devoted to his wife. But these two men, nevertheless, clicked and formed a friendship.
Well, Salameh was obviously westernized because you're not allowed to drink wine if you're a
right. No. Well,
a serious Muslim.
Well, again, in the 60s and 70s, you know, the PLO and Fatah was a secular organization.
How did Ames get Salameh to open up a back channel for the CIA to the PLO?
Well, Ames arrived in Beirut in 1969 after a posting in Aden, and he met a young Lebanese Shiite businessman named Mustafa Zain.
You've called him the Arab Zelig.
Yes.
Is it significant that he was a Shiite and not a Sunni?
Yes, it was, because Lebanon is a mosaic. And in the 60s, the Shia were a distinct minority and a underrepresented, dispossessed minority. And today, they are represented by Hezbollah. So this is a key fact.
And they dominate.
And they dominate the
politics of Lebanon.
Yeah, exactly.
In the past, the Constitution required that a Christian be the head of state. That's no longer the case.
Oh, I think actually it is the case. Yeah, no, it's still the sectarian. They still haven't been able to write a real constitution. It still dates back to the census population of 1932.
Well, how did Mustafa Zain and Ames become friends?
They met through a mutual acquaintance, and Ames pursued the relationship. And Zain refused to become an agent. He absolutely took no money throughout his relationship with Ames. But Ames knew very soon from Mustafa that Mustafa was good friends with Ali Hassan. And so Mustafa set up a meeting, a very clandestine meeting, on Rue Hamra at the Strand Cafe. And it was a classic sort of spy walk-by where each was had the chance to identify the other. And then they met in the safe house in Beirut later on.
Weren't you told that he would be impossible to find when you were researching the book?
Yes.
So how did you find him?
Well, I heard about Mustafa from my CIA sources. And one of them said, well, you know, you can't tell the story without finding Mustafa. And it took me 18 months. And I thought he was living in Florida at one point and had a source knock on the apartment door in Florida, and he wasn't there. Finally, someone gave me a cell phone number in the Middle East. I called it cold on Skype, and Mustafa answered, and I explained who I was and what I was doing, and his first question was, how did you get this number? But Mustafa turned out to be an incredible source, and he had letters that Ames had written to him, handwritten letters. He had an unpublished memoir. He had documents, photographs.
And he made all that available to
and
you?
And eventually he made all that available to me.
My guest is Kai Bird, whose latest book is The Good Spy, The Life and Death of Robert Ames. Now, you couldn't have spoken to Salomé because he's dead, but how did Ames feel about Salomé's role in terrorist attacks against Israel? Didn't he play a role in the 1972 massacre at the Munich Olympics?
Ali Hassan Salomé, certainly, the Red Prince, was certainly a man with blood on his hands. He packed a pistol. There's a picture in the book of him, and you can visibly see his gun in his waistband. And he was in part of Black September.
Which was the terror arm.
The sort of the shadowy terror arm of Fatah in the 70s. And in the book, I say that he was, without any doubt, led five major attacks in Europe. But there is some mystery about and controversy about whether he was involved in the terrible Munich tragedy in the Olympics where 11 Israeli athletes were killed.
But still, wouldn't that color his relationship with somebody who has to trust him?
Absolutely. And, you know, I have letters where I quote from Ames writing to Mustafa Zain about the Munich affair, and he's really torn. But, you know, in this business, I was told the old saying by one of my intelligence sources, you know, if you choose to sup with the devil, you should do it with a very long spoon.
And but still, Ames considered Salomé a friend, which is beyond a long spoon.
He supped with the devil with a very short spoon. And he would, when he was in Beirut, he would have dinner at Ali Hassan's private apartment, and he knew his wife and children. And then he even advised Ali Hassan against taking a second wife. And Ali Hassan ignored this advice. He went on to marry Georgina Rizik, the Miss Universe of 1971. And Ames, when asked by Ali Hassan, he agreed to send them to Disneyland and Hawaii on a vacation. It's a remarkable story.
Were there any dangers involved in these two men working together?
Oh, yes.
Especially since, the way you describe it, it was fairly open.
Well, it was open in Beirut, but, you know,
people had to know that they were having dinner together. The American people guessed spy and Salomé.
Yes. Inside PLO circles, it was probably among some people an open secret that this was happening, but it was happening with Arafat's blessing. And yet, this Ali Hassan was a man who was being hunted throughout the 10-year period of Ames's relationship with him from 1969 to 79. Mossad was trying to kill Ali Hassan.
Now, the CIA was pushing for Ali Hassan to become a paid CIA spy. He wasn't willing to do that. Did he give the kind of information that a paid spy would be expected to give?
He did.
So he served pretty much the same role, except that he wouldn't take money.
He wouldn't take money. He wouldn't take orders. But, it was a two-way street. At the same time that Ali Hassan was giving the Ames intelligence about terrorist plots that the PLO disapproved of from people like Abu Nidal. At the same time, Ali Hassan was trying to draw the CIA into a relationship.
And the attempt was to come up with strategies to broker a peace deal between Israel and the PLO?
Well, Ames was trying to broker, to push Arafat in the direction of laying down the guns and acting like a political party and envisioning a political compromise, a two-state solution. And in fact, this is regarded inside the CIA, this is regarded as the beginnings of the sort of what we call the Oslo peace process.
Ali Hassan was very close to Arafat?
Very close.
What would have Henry Kissinger's response have been if he had known that we were paying Salome? Would that have caused a conflict within the U.S. government?
Well, publicly, Henry Kissinger was saying we're having nothing to do with the PLO, and publicly he had promised the Israelis that we would never talk to them. But within months of Ames's first meeting of Salome, Henry Kissinger certainly knew.
And did Ames's insistence on putting a high premium on their friendship ever have a negative impact on his ability to do his job or his ability to relate to the people back at the Home Office?
Well, he had...
They see him as freelancing?
No. They saw this as a breakthrough, but they did see him, you know, as someone who was going off the reservation without explicit orders.
After Arafat disbanded Black September, why did the Mossad remain intent on assassinating Salome?
This is another big mystery that's debated in the book. Why did they continue to pursue an assassination plot against Salome?
Because they must have been aware of the fact that he was also a valuable source for the Americans,
exactly.
For the CIA. The Mossad and the CIA talk all the time.
He was both a symbol of Palestinian terrorism, but they also knew that he was the back channel. And that was in the 1970s, their greatest fear was to see Arafat on the White House lawn. And in fact, that's, of course, what happened in Oslo during the Oslo peace process.
But it was okay to have Sadat on the White House lawn?
Well, Sadat was the head of state in Egypt. Yasser Arafat was the chairman of a terrorist organization.
How did Ames react to the assassination of Salome?
I have an eyewitness who said the blood drained from his face. He turned white. He was very angry. He, in fact, had heard about the renewed attempts. He had tried to warn Ali Hassan Salome. He had sent him communication equipment, encrypted communication equipment, to upgrade his security. He tried to persuade him to come on board and let us tell the Israelis that you're our guy, you're our agent. He was very angry that the Israelis had done this. He thought it was a major mistake.
My guest is Kai Bird. His latest book, The Good Spy, The Life and Death of Robert Ames. Ames spent the 60s and 70s in some of the most dangerous conflict zones in the Middle East. Was he ever concerned about his own safety?
He was. And as I said earlier, he did occasionally carry a gun, but he disliked carrying a gun. He actually wrote to his wife, Yvonne, at one point that he thought it was useless because if he was going to be attacked, it would be from behind and he'd never see the bullet coming.
Some members of the CIA felt that Ames was too sympathetic to the Palestinians. Is there any indication that in his work that he favored one side over the other?
Oh, I think he was certainly highly sympathetic to the Palestinian plight, to the plight of the refugees. But later on in his career, he switched from the clandestine side to the analytical side, rising to become chief of the analytical division. And in that capacity, he had to go to Israel two or three times a year and meet with his counterparts in the Mossad, the intelligence group there. And I interviewed some of these guys, and they knew exactly who he was. They knew that he was the back channel to the Red Prince. And yet they had a certain respect for him. They understood that he was no ideologue and that he had a certain empathy for the Israeli security dilemma as well.
How did he feel about President Reagan's understanding of the Middle East and its conflicts and people in Washington in general?
He was very frustrated. He was, by the end of his career in 1982, 83, he had risen to a point where he was the guy to brief Ronald Reagan in the White House, in the Oval Office, or at Camp David whenever anything came up about the Middle East. And he was the ghost author of Reagan's September 1982 Peace Initiative, which, again, is a remarkable document laying out for the first time America's position on what they thought a peace settlement would look like.
Was he being too optimistic in believing that Lebanon would sign the initiative, particularly after Anwar Sadat had been assassinated for signing a peace treaty with Israel?
He was optimistic, and he was accused of being naive by his colleagues. But he was trying, and he was, I argue in the book, he was an idealistic but pragmatic intelligence officer who was trying to do his job as best he could.
You have to wonder what would have happened if he hadn't died, been killed, because the situation remains, if anything, is maybe even worse today than it was then.
I agree. I think it's much worse today.
Because it seems to be more intractable.
It's more intractable. There's 30 years more of war and hatred and casualties. It's very sad.
The PLO provided the U.S. with security in Beirut. Why was that? And why did they decide to leave in 1982?
Well, this is one of the bonuses that came from the relationship between Ames and the Red Prince. When they formed this clandestine back-channel relationship, the Red Prince offered and the CIA accepted that Fatah would provide security service for the American embassy, which happened to be in a part of Beirut which was controlled by Fatah. And this became very important as the Lebanese Civil War began in 1975.
And then they pulled out because Israel was in Lebanon at that point?
Well, in the summer of 1982, the Israelis invaded Lebanon, laid siege to Beirut, expelled the PLO, and then there was this terrible massacre at Sabra and Shatila, where up to 2,000 people were killed in the refugee camps. And this everything went downhill after this, and the embassy became a target.
And Ames was trying to broker a deal to get the Israelis to withdraw from Lebanon.
Yes. Not only he, but the U.S. government and Ronald Reagan was demanding the Israelis to withdraw.
Why was he in Beirut on April 18, 1983?
Well, Ames hadn't been back to Beirut in nearly 5 years. His last visit was there in 78 when he was seeing Ali Hassan. This is shortly before Ali Hassan was killed by Mossad, so he thought it was overdue that it was time for him to renew some of his contacts, and so he just happened to arrive in Beirut the day before a truck bomb rolled in and destroyed the building, killing 63 people, 17 Americans, and including 8 CIA officers.
Do we know who was behind that truck bombing?
Well, at the time, this was a mystery. Truck bomb attacks were a real rarity. One or two had happened in Lebanon before this, but over the years, the suspicion has been that Hezbollah was behind it. But Hezbollah didn't really exist in 1983. And in my book, I actually believe I've solved the mystery. It was an operation carried out by Iranian Revolutionary Guard officers stationed in Baalbek. And I actually named some of the officers involved.
Including Ali Reza Asghari, who lives in the United States now, doesn't he?
Well, we don't actually know where he is physically at this moment. But at some point, yes, in the year 2007, long after Ali Reza Asghari had a long career in Beirut and Lebanon as an Iranian intelligence officer and then rose to become a deputy defense minister, he defected in 2007 from Iran through Turkey to the United States. And at one point, he was debriefed in a CIA safe house somewhere in Virginia.
This sounds like one of the subplots of Homeland.
Oh, it is. You know, Homeland is in some ways a gross exaggeration, but Homeland gets it right in one respect, in that intelligence is all about personal relationships.
We have very little time left, but that bombing really changed the U.S.'s sense of what it should do in the Middle East, didn't it?
Oh, it was a devastating blow. Ronald Reagan decided after Ames was killed that he really couldn't pursue his Reagan peace initiative. And 6 months later, the Marine barracks were attacked in a similar truck bomb. And at that point, Reagan withdrew the Marines and really gave up on the Middle East. And things just went downhill after that.
And intelligence has not been as good either, as we learned before the invasion of Iraq.
Yeah, no, it's been all downhill from 9/11 to the Iraq War. I think we're still in a very bad place in terms of intelligence.
Kai Bird is the co-author or author of four previous books, American Prometheus, Crossing Mandelbaum Gate, The Chairman, and The Color of the Truth. His latest, The Good Spy, The Life and Death of Robert Ames, published by Crown. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you, Leonard. It was a pleasure.